It is the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Back again. Complicated times require sophisticated techniques. So what do you say we try to develop some of those, sort of up our game out there a little bit in our public discourse and our debates? I'm Dr. Dan French, rhetoric PhD, escaped professor, also a longtime stand-up, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. I write a lot of stuff on rhetoric over at Substack. You can go over there and check some of that out, like persuasion for parents. If you're tired of yelling at your kids, talk them into different positions. Here on the podcast, I do three things. I talk to comedians about their careers and their politics. You always get interesting perspectives from those brains. I convert people. I actually do persuasion on here, especially with conservatives, because they worry me. So, but anybody who wants to come at and on and talk about their perspective, I'd be happy to do that. And I talk to persuasion professionals and academics who are studying this stuff and adjacent stuff. That includes social issue people, politicians, and of course, more rhetoricians on this podcast than you'll find anywhere else today. My guest today, I guess I've interviewed a lot of academics, but you may be the first like pure philosopher.
Ooh.
So you're the number one philosophy guest. She's an author, speaker, philosophy professor, focused on ethics, especially military, business, and policy, currently professing at the Naval War College, Pauline Shanks Karin.
Karin. Yeah, really close. Thank you.
Darn close.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. And I'll just say up front, as we always have to, that here in my personal capacity, and not as a representative of the Department of Defense or Department of Navy. So, but I'm thrilled to be here. Some of my best friends are rhetoricians, excited to be your first philosopher. Hopefully I don't muck it up for the rest of the philosophers.
There's a statement. Some of my best friends are rhetoricians. You don't hear that one very often.
Yeah.
So you know, rhetoricians. So like from, philosophy and rhetoric are very adjacent, right? So
yeah,
we trade back and forth all the time. It's basically language philosophy. You know, there's a lot of foundation there. So I've always really enjoyed taking philosophy stuff, but man, you guys really think. You guys really get down into the weeds of thinking.
We do. Yeah, that's kind of our thing. So that's why we don't get invited to dinner parties. So.
Well, I've got two reasons not to be invited to dinner parties. One, because I deconstruct everybody's rhetoric of what they believe. And two, because I'm a stand-up comic and I just then make fun of it. So, I'll make a bad dinner guest, I guess. So let's just start with some of your background, just sort of get us oriented a little bit to who you are and what you do.
Currently I'm at the U.S. Naval War College. I'm the James Stockdale Chair in Professional Military Ethics, but I'm a Montana girl, grew up in Montana. Went to college in the Midwest, and then did a master's degree in philosophy at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg, and then went to Temple in a very scenic North Philadelphia for a PhD.
Yeah, and my candidate of Philadelphia. That's
yeah. Yeah. So get around a little bit. And my dissertation was on moral character and the My Lai massacre. So I do military ethics, but I spent over 20 years teaching at a small comprehensive university. So liberal arts and professional schools in Tacoma, Washington, Pacific Lutheran University. And I chaired the philosophy department there and taught everything from business ethics to philosophy of law to social and political philosophy.
A little production note. I'm not sure why I'm getting some scratchy, like I don't know if it's your earrings.
Yeah, I think earrings. It's probably my earrings. So taught a class on the Tea Party, just taught all kinds of different courses, but especially in military ethics. And then was offered this job at the as the Stockdale Chair, which is sort of the top of the tree in military ethics. So a chance to go do something different, teaching graduate students and working with the Navy and the military more broadly on questions of leader development and military ethics.
Yeah. You know, academics spend so much time outside the actual real life institutional bubbles, commenting inward, but you're kind of sitting inside now.
Right? I am. I'm inside now after having been outside for over 20 years. So that's an interesting, I did teach ROTC at Pacific Lutheran University, and taught some of their students, but it's very different being on the inside.
We were talking about this before we started. I did a day seminar way back, probably 25 years ago now, at the Strategic Studies Institute. And I think they disbanded it since then, but, Admiral Hogg was in charge of it. And I talked to him for an hour. And then I sat around for, I guess, a total of 6 hours and talked to the people that were in their seminar series, maybe 40 or 50 different people from different branches of the military. And it was ostensibly about comedy, but then it became about rhetoric because they didn't really know anything about sort of either one of these worlds. And their mission statement, I guess, was to come up with encounter different viewpoints of the world. And so they started with comedy and then like, what's this rhetoric thing? And it was fascinating because this, I think it was still during Desert Storm, and they, you know, just that perspective, they actually showed some video that, you know, was from the night before of some attack. And I'm like, oh, you guys do this for real.
Yeah. Yeah. I have students. I mean, I have mostly military students in my classes, some civilians from say State Department or other, government agencies, but these are students that have had been there, done that, like real world experience. And so it, you know, I bring the ethics, I bring the philosophical disposition and the questions and the text, but then that comes into conversation with their experiences and what they've been through and what they've seen and what their perspectives are. And of course, since it's joint professional military education, a class is not just Navy students. It's Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard. We also have a fairly large contingent of international students as well from over 50 different countries. So it's quite a range of people that you get in any given class. And so it's just, you know, the fun part of my job is just getting to pick my students' brains about what they think about stuff that I think about from a theoretical perspective.
Right.
And I try to talk to people who have that practical experience, but it's interesting to bring those two into conversation
together. Sure. I'm still getting feedback. I'm not sure what you're brushing against, but it's...
Can I try without the headset?
Yeah, let's try without the headset.
Is that any better?
Let's see. Talk a little bit.
Let me see. Let me switch the phone. How's that? Is that any better?
Yeah, I think you're better. Like it was just something brushing up against the microphone about every 11 seconds.
Yeah, it might be that. Hopefully the dog will be quiet in the background. So
that's okay. I've had dogs on here before too, so it's expected. You know, I think this is an interesting juncture from sort of an educational perspective, especially when you see the collision of real life, real lived phenomenology, real deep experience with your issues that you're coming at, you know, from an intellectual academic perspective. Part of my degree was in cultural studies. And so there's a lot of ethnographic work there. You know, they go out and really glean that sort of lived experience and then bring it back and marry it up with theory. And that's the first time I really experienced that, where you're seeing like, oh, I'm talking about this stuff and I have, you know, all this sort of things infusing it, but what I don't always have is the actual experience itself.
Yeah. So some of it is them having time, especially with the deployment schedule, right? And the operation of Tempos schedule. Some of it is them. This is a 10-month program. So for many of them, this is the first time they've had a chance to kind of step back and take, it's not necessarily a break, but it's a chance to, it's more like a sabbatical where they have time to reflect, where they have time to be back with their families. and to really think about and process some of what they've been through. So at least in my classes, including our core class in leadership and ethics, we're really intentional about asking them to process and asking them to reflect on their experiences, and then to think about where they're going next and what they think that environment is going to be like. So that's part of it too, is getting them to think creatively about the unknown. We all have our ideas about what the environment is going to be like, but as we've seen in the last year and a half, like our ideas about what's going to happen are incomplete at best. We had been wargaming pandemics for a while, but I don't know that how this turned out was what people had anticipated. In fact, it's pretty clearly not what right. people had anticipated. So we're also educating them, as I did when I taught liberal arts students, we're educating people for a murky future. We can see in the glass, but dimly, as St. Paul said. So that's part of the challenge too, is thinking about what can we do with students in 10 months to help them be prepared, even though we don't know where they're going. They may not know where they're going, and we may not know what they're facing. So that's part of the context too.
Yeah, I talk sometimes now about, because I stopped teaching college in the mid 2000s. I'd moved over into doing entertainment studies and teaching screenwriting and TV writing at UT Austin. And I had already worked in Hollywood for 10 years at that point, like actively in TV and late night comedy writing. And so I knew the way Hollywood actually worked. And I knew that phenomenology. And the students were coming up through UT Austin and had learned this sort of abstraction, and they didn't really know what they were getting into. And I kept telling them, like, do you know how obsessive people in Hollywood are that you're going to be competing with? Like in the talent level that you're going up against. And when you combine obsession and talent, you're in a real ball game there. And they never did. And I never could communicate it fully so that they would understand how prepared they need to get now because of what was coming up. And, you know, kind of the same thing, I would assume, like these very complicated cultural environments and military environments and everything else. How do you actually bring those to life enough to make people see how much they need the abstract?
Yeah, I think it's hard because most of our students come to us and they are very proficient, high achievers, and they've gotten to where they've gotten in their careers because they're very good at the tactical level, right? And so as we often say at the War College, what got you here won't get you there. In other words, the things that made you successful up until this point may not help you, and in fact may actually detract from your future right. success. So it's getting them to be willing to think about the fact that maybe they have things to learn. And so that's where the abstract piece comes in. And at first, all students can be a little resistant, but usually by a couple of weeks in, they start to see that, okay, well, maybe there's some stuff I'm going to have to think about that I haven't thought about before. But yeah, it can be a challenge, especially in the leadership space, because they come to us and they're leaders.
Right.
And then in the ethics space, they often will say to me as the Stockdale chair, well, I'm a good moral person. I love Jesus. I love my wife, you know, whatever it is. And so getting them to think about, well, maybe there's some things that you haven't thought about, or you haven't thought about in the way that we're going to ask you to think about things in your different core courses. And so they may be planning military operations one semester and then reading Thucydides and reflecting on strategy another semester in between reading, say, you know, Just War Thinking Philosophy with me, or thinking about empathy, which they may not be a fan of thinking about. They're like, oh, you know, I don't need empathy. So some of it is also like all of us, like we think we have skills, we think we have capacities, and it becomes about learning what you don't know, or maybe unlearning some things that you thought you knew. which I think with the pandemic has been, we've been unlearning ways of being in the world in a certain way, and then having to relearn new ones like wearing masks and navigating socially with each other if we're wearing masks. Like, what does that look like? You know, that kind of thing, being in the office together versus now being on Zoom.
Right.
And trying to figure out what that looks like. So,
yeah, it turns out the whole thinking thing kind of comes in handy all the time, right? Turns out you don't really arrive at the answers and then just use those the rest of your life.
Yeah. And part of it is, I think our students and just the military in general, they're very results driven, as they should be. And so there's a lot of focus on the product, on the end state is our favorite military term. And try to get them to back up and say, well, maybe there's some value in how you get to the end state, that it may not be about that or just about that. The deliberation process matters.
Yeah, I would guess in the military that, I mean, this sort of pragmatism, this American pragmatism, right, of what's the use of this?
Yeah.
And that's one of the institutions that surely has absorbed that and uses that as a main ethos for what it does. I run into it. Luckily, rhetoric is mostly about use, right? It's it's got this hardcore internal directive to win, you know. So people, I can usually get it in pretty easily once people understand what it is. That, oh, this is a thing to help you win more, and then they're kind of down with it because Americans like that idea.
Yeah, sure. Who doesn't like to win? I guess the way I approach it is that what I bring to the table is helping you think about, clarify your own thinking, because what winning is going to mean probably in the future is not just kinetic force or who has the coolest technology, because those advantages are going to be very short-lived. And I think lots of people like P.W. Singer in Wired for War, and he and August Cole in their novels and their science fiction have made the case that, you know, the technology is, you know, the advantages that you get from technology are pretty short-lived, but an advantage that's more durable is the human element, and in particular things like creativity, being able to be adaptive thinkers, being able to be empathetic, to engage in moral discourse, to engage in rhetoric, how we talk about things. All of these things are going to be part of the future environment in ways that, you know, maybe they haven't been in the past, or that we haven't seen their impact. And I think the rise of social media and information warfare and all of that kind of thing. Now we see the importance. I think people are talking about rhetoric much more than they were like 5-6 years ago, right? Especially in the political domain, right? How we think about rhetoric and much of our rhetoric, especially for Americans, is tinged with moral and ethical language or values language. So is it getting them to think about, maybe there's some skills as senior leaders that you are going to need to have that maybe you didn't need to have up until this point, actually would have been a disadvantage up to this point, but now you're going into a different environment.
So I'm curious, the word ethics, I define as I try to brand something about rhetoric that I can use to get regular humans to be interested in it. One of the taglines I have for it is that I tend to teach the power of ethical only rhetoric. So it allows me to cleave rhetoric, at least, you know, intellectually, into two camps. So it begins at least a simple conversation of, here's a lot of unethical techniques that the nefarious or the utilitarians just use all the time. And I can identify those, like they're literally identifiable as technique. And if we would take these out of the public discourse, we'd probably have a cleaner public discourse. And so I tend not to like to teach people the nefarious techniques, the dark arts. I used to tell students when I taught advanced persuasion first day, I'm like, let's say there are 1,000 techniques of persuasion. 600 of them I'm not going to teach you because you can't handle it. You don't have the ethical foundations to use them correctly. and it would infuriate them. Like, you have to.
Yeah, of course.
but it's an interesting word, that ethics. Of course, you know, it's a slippery word. It's a, you know, difficult word to hold in place, but it does allow you to give, you know, that at least sort of good versus bad narrative that Americans, again, like so much, you know, the two-sidedism that they like so much.
Yeah, I use ethical in a very particular way. And so with my students, I distinguish between moral and ethical. So moral is any claim about what's right or wrong, regardless of whether it's an individual or an institution or a society. So there's a logical structure. Moral claims are claims about right and wrong. Ethics is the study of those claims, the analysis of those claims, discourse around those claims, justification, questioning of those claims. So if I say to you, well, I don't eat bacon on Thursdays, that's a moral claim. But as soon as you ask me, Pauline, why don't you do that? And then we start to have a conversation about my reasons, then we're engaged in ethics, right? And I think this distinction is important for my students, especially because most of them to this point are in fact moral leaders, right? They have a sense of their own, I hate the analogy, but their own moral compass. But that's not enough as a leader. As a leader, you have to be able to navigate moral disagreement because people have different ideas about what's right and wrong, and articulate your moral vision and have difficult conversations about morality with other people. So I argue that what we do at the War College, and even what I did with undergraduate business, whether it was business students or ROTC students or just your run-of-the-mill student, was to prepare them for ethical leadership, which is to be able to walk into an organization or into a group or into their family structures or their communities and be able to think about their own moral vision and their own moral claims and be able to articulate that to other people. So for me, ethics is, it is that, there is that dimension of right and wrong, but it's beyond that. It's being able to say, here's why I think this is right or wrong, or to have a conversation with other people about differing views. So I tend to think of ethics in that broader frame. And I know some people want to use the dictionary definition, which as a philosopher I detest, or go with the the roots of the words, but that's how I use them because of the logical structure. So anything that is X is right, X is wrong, that's, we're talking about morality, we're talking about a moral claim. Ethics is the next analytical level above that. And I think also once you open that up, then it opens up the possibility that we could have conversations about why people think what they do. And I think Americans, when it comes to moral questions, often have a really difficult time having these conversations because we, through our history, have been inclined to think of morality as a matter of personal conscience. And it's a private thing. It's like religion. You don't talk about it. But I think part of where we are in our country, and have been for quite a long time, it's not new in the United States, is that there are fundamentally different moral worldviews. Mm-hmm. And people from those different worldviews are having a difficult time talking to each other. And I think part of that is that it's hard for people to articulate why they think what they think. And so I think that's a really important capacity, and it's an important skill set to give people so they can have these conversations.
Do you think that's, so again, I run in this all the time. I came from a working class background, first person in my family to go to college. And so I've seen what education can actually do to transform general intelligence into useful, you know, intelligence and discourse and choice making and that kind of stuff. And I've always wanted, you know, I like the idea of bringing those techniques to people so that you elevate them so that they make better decisions, they have better life structures, better leaders and all that. And that's kind of what got me into being a professor, right? Like, I'm going to bring this back to the people. Like I did to my family, you know, go back and teach my mom stuff. And I got her back into college and all this stuff because I just valued it so much. But finding the same level of value of that kind of sort of hyper formal, you know, a deeper understanding of this stuff so that it becomes functional, it's kind of hard to find in the world. Like for people that will commit to that kind of level of learning where it becomes functional, like you're talking about. So if you do learn that, oh, there's this moral sense that I have about the world and what I believe is right and wrong, but now let me go in and question that and then let other people question it with me. That's some stuff that Americans, yeah, they just blow up on it pretty fast.
Yeah, I think some of it is because that the capacity to do that, like we are, human beings are what I call epistemological conservatives. So when it comes to our theories of knowledge, we tend to be conservative. Like we tend not to, and this is why the conspiracy theory thing is really interesting, but we tend not to embrace ideas that require us to reorient all of our beliefs. So we tend to hold beliefs that fit with the beliefs we already have. And reorganizing all that stuff is really, it's upsetting, it's threatening to our identities. It can be threatening to our social bonds. So any college student knows this who have gone away to college and you come back that first time for the first set of holidays, and maybe you're questioning the religious perspective you were grew up with or your family's political perspective, right? It can really sever bonds. I mean, we're finding this with the vaccine debates, with our political debates, with gender and race, right? These are things that the differences are disorienting and cleaving. So part of it for me is also about helping people have these conversations in ways that they can still maintain their identity. They can still maintain some of these relationships. So is there a way to be in these conversations and not be a jerk and be empathetic? Now, of course, there's some people we don't want to be empathetic with or respectful to in conversations. But I think, you know, most of the conversations that are happening, we could, instead of making assertions, we could ask questions. This is part of my issue with once in a while on Twitter or on social media, I will remind people of my ground rules about how I engage in discourse, like in hopes that maybe other people will bear that in mind. I know it's a fool's errand, but I'm sort of optimistic that way. But can you, instead of making a claim or challenging someone's claim, start with a question and say, that's really interesting, Dan. Can you tell me like how you came to that or where that comes from? Because that's not my experience. So rather than saying, you're wrong, Dan, because that's not my experience, I could say, okay, tell me about like how you got there, because that's not something that comes from my experience. So I think some of it is, you're right, the tolerance to have conversations, which I think right now is at a fairly low level. But also, are there better and worse ways to have the conversation, right? And does it depend who you're talking to? So I'm going to approach things in my classroom very different than I'm going to approach things when I'm having a conversation with my mom, who's in her 70s, right? We're not going to the same places. Or how I approach conversations with my undergraduates, or how I approach them with my teenagers. So are there different ways for us to have conversations than maybe we've been having them in the past? And I think social media and even cable news, I mean, I came up in, you know, the 80s and early 90s, sort of the beginning of the, you know, the CNN generation and the pundit, you know, like I grew up on Crossfire, CNN show, right? Before Tucker Carlson was who he is now. Right. And maybe those aren't very good models for having like conversations with people you want to maintain relationships with. So is that part of what we have to think about? Which isn't to say like we're never going to have disagreements and it's all like touchy-feely and Pollyanna, happy, happy, happy. But are there ways in which we could at least sometimes disagree that are more productive and helpful?
And because I design out, you know, transformations, like any type of persuasion, knowing some type of pattern for it so that you've got pre-made techniques and things like that. You know, it's one of the things rhetoric loves to do. I tell people, like, when I have conservatives on the podcast and I'm doing conversions on them in an ethical manner, so I let them know what I'm doing. I'm like, here's my techniques. And I have designed out, like, if you want to do some type of conversion on somebody that's heightened, like in a heightened emotional state, highly triggerable, is not really, you know, using a lot of logic at this point. They're using a lot of scripted, you know, absorbed statements, claims. And so the first thing, like, I think it's just a three-step process of just sit there and just gather information, like just zen, like a therapist, like, tell me everything you think and why do you think this way? And if you can listen without judgment, which is really hard to do, they will continue to talk to you. You know, but nobody wants to talk to somebody who's challenging and contradicting and showing pain and all that. And so if you can do that, then you create a relationship. And once you've got a relationship, it can sustain a little bit of conflict. But until you've got a persuasive relationship set up, don't try to do active persuasion, especially with logic, because it is just going to lock you up and, you know, super trigger them and super trigger you, and you're not going to get anywhere. But just training people, like something like that, like, think of yourself in this way when you're going into this discussion. You're not here to just have a discussion. You're trying to convert somebody. Yeah. And that's okay. As long as you're doing it ethically, it's a perfectly fine human activity.
Yeah. I think for conversations, I think it's important to just, you know, it depends what your intention is. So when I walk into my classroom at the Naval War College, my intent is usually not to persuade, right? But I think regardless of what your intent is, I think many people in our society want to be heard. And for some people, they feel like they aren't heard unless you agree with them, right? Which is an issue we have to deal with. But, you know, all of those techniques that we all learned, right, about active listening and here's what I hear you saying. Is that what your intention is? And tell me more about, like, the therapist, tell me more about how you got there. Because I think, you know, I did much better. I remember when I first started teaching, I was so incredibly nervous until I wrapped my head around the fact that teaching is building a relationship with not a group of students, but with each student individually. We just all happen to be in the room at the same time.
Yeah.
And the same with public speaking, right? And so I think if you can develop a relationship, and then it becomes not that you agree necessarily with them, but are there places where I think we jump right to the, well, it's a matter of if I'm right, then they have to be wrong. We see things in very binary ways. Instead of maybe occupying a middle space, like that first space, I really like what you're saying, because that's what we try to do in academia, in theory, right? Just to try to explore views without judgment. You got to understand Plato's view first. And then you can take issue with it after you understand it, not from your perspective, but from his perspective. Can you articulate it as if you were Plato? And then we can go into asking critical questions, and then we can start mounting arguments or objections, understanding the possibility that there might be options other than I'm right and you're wrong. And I think, you know, John Stuart Mill in On Liberty said this really, really well. Like, it could be the case that the disputed truth is all wrong. It could be that it's all right, but it also could be that it has part of the truth and part falsity. And so I think a lot of what we think actually falls into that middle category. It may be that you have some piece of truth or some piece of a perspective that I really need to hear. And it may be that I have something to contribute to. So I think we tend to think of it in terms of this very, especially in our politics, it's very either or, right? And I don't think that's productive in terms of conversation, but either in terms of if you're really trying to persuade someone or convert someone to your view, like, I think they have to be open to that possibility or it's not going to be very successful. Like, you have to have an opening. You have to have some common ground. You have to have some place to start from. And as you pointed out, I think there's this assumption that the way you win arguments, whoever has the best logical case is going to win. And I'm here to tell you, like, as a philosopher, if that were the case, like, I'd be out of the job. Right. If it was just like, okay, the abortion debate, we just go find a logician and y'all write out your arguments and formal logic, and whoever has the right modus tollens move, we're done. But of course, that's not how it works, because it's not just a matter of rationality. And emotion is not necessarily irrational either. And that's the other piece, is I don't think in our culture we have a good relationship with emotion. And certainly in many of the professions that I deal with, whether that's business or the military, emotion is viewed, first of all, in a gendered way, and second of all, in a, well, it's, if you're using emotion, it's irrational.
Yeah, it's fascinating when you actually do just a little bit of deduction work on any issue with somebody, and you show them how many assumed settled claim areas there are.
Yeah.
In every word. And I'm like, there's no way we're ever going to agree like in this 100% sense. If we can just agree on a definition, that's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And that's just one word in these thousands of words that we're throwing at each other. So if you actually look at what the task is of reaching agreement, that's pretty unusual.
Or just the how assumptions function, right? So I often tell my, so we hear that, well, you need to challenge your assumptions, right? And I tell my students, like, you can't challenge what you can't find. So the first task is to find what your assumptions are, because very often it's easy for us to find other people's assumptions. I could identify your assumptions in your argument, but it's very difficult for me to see my own. And so that's something in all of my classes, whether it was teaching undergraduate or now teaching at the War College, I spend a lot of time, we'll do a simple like scenario, you know, so what would you do in this scenario? And the students will give their view, but then a lot of that is unpacking what their assumptions are going into how they answered that question, or what their emotional reactions to things were, and what assumptions are built into that. So much of this is also just, we import so many assumptions to things that we're not aware of, and they're doing all kinds of work for us that are unacknowledged, which is often why people can't, it's hard to have conversations, because you're literally speaking different languages, or you're literally starting from, you know, sort of different sets of assumptions. And then it's hard to even really communicate, because you're not speaking the same language in a certain kind of way.
Yeah. And I think when you run into new technologies like social media, where you can now have a multi-log, you know, with the world, like that's never happened before, in real time, talking to, you know, 100, 500, thousands of people who get to respond through a channel, and good luck with your brain being able to handle that. Right.
Yeah. We're not built for that. We're built evolutionarily for small groups, right? Where there are social bonds, where there are norms and there are rules, especially, I mean, there are nominally some rules on social media, but not really, which is why I tend to remind people every 6 months about what my rules are. And
what are your rules, by the way?
They're basically the same as they are in the classroom, which is that I welcome pretty much not any perspective, but most perspectives, if you can make your case, and if we can have a discussion in the spirit of discovery. Right. So if you're here to troll, I'm not interested in that. If you're going to, you know, use insults, if you are going to mansplain, vetsplain, whatever the, you know, sort of condescending explaining to me is, philosophers are terrible at this, right? So it's there's a spirit of empathy and care that I want as a part of my conversations. Are you here to explore? Are you here to challenge my views and have your views challenged? But I also will tell people, like, rather than make a claim or start from a place of critique, I'd like you to start from a place of understanding. I'd like you to start from a place of questioning and then move to critique. And I always make my students do that. Like, they don't get to start with critique.
Right.
They have to start with the understanding, and then they can move to critique and then counter argument and defend themselves and all these other kinds of things. And I know civility is not a popular word, and the criticisms of it are fair. And in fact, John Stuart Mill has a criticism of it in the 19th century. But I think there is something to, are there some norms or ways in which we're going to have conversations, which may need to be difficult. I'm a big fan of Brené Brown's work and having really hard, tough conversations. But I think though there are ways to do that without being, excuse my French, asshole, right? That you really can push back on people's views, but you can do it in a way that is from a standpoint of trying to understand a discovery. And then once you get to that point, you can say, listen, I really think you're wrong on this, Dan, and here's why, and here's what my evidence is, as opposed to me insulting, you know, your appearance or your mother, or, you know, you're just a conservative, so you don't understand this, or whatever it is. So, and I, you know, like all of us, I sometimes fall short of the glory and don't maintain my own rules. But I find that I have more productive conversations. I try not to mute people. I try not to block people, although I will, you know, people are becoming abusive, especially if they're, it's one thing if they're being abusive to me, but they're being abusive to other people in the conversation. And that's where this is like in the classroom, that gets shut down really fast, right? I'm not doing that. And so I think there are some places where we have to say, this is not how we're going to have this discussion. Like, if that's the vibe of discussion that you like, so there's some elements of certain niche groups, say within Twitter, that enjoy insulting each other, right? And it's kind of a game and it's kind of fun, and that's fine. But if I'm asking you, you know, a philosophical question, that's not the place for that, right? If you don't like how someone is responding to my question about the nature of liberty.
Yeah, it's fascinating because I move across different strong worlds, like in stand-up, you know, comedy. I tell people in comedy clubs, you know, or people ask me, do I ever get heckled? And I'm like, almost never, because for one thing, I know how to set an environment so mm-hmm. that there's not any space for them to talk. If they're typically, if I'm handling the talk well, they don't want to stop it. Mm-hmm. And if they do, I've been doing this for over 30 years. I shred them, like, and I tell them, like, if somebody will say something, usually they're just drunk and not even trying to be aggressive or whatever, but I'm like, you know, that's all you got? Are you done? So, cause I have a microphone and a spotlight and I've been doing this a long time. So if you want to play, just let me know, because I'm going to eviscerate you, like, in a way that you'll remember probably the rest of your life. That's what you're stepping into. Do you want to play? And so that they understand, like, I have a certain, it's like, you know, Taken. I have a certain set of skills that are going to make me a nightmare for you right now. Just decide if you want to play. And if they do, then we do. But
yeah, and I think for me, it is also about setting the environment. I've been told by, you know, almost 30 years of students that there's what my words say, and then there's what my face says. And so I think very often my face eviscerates before my language, like, shows up. So there's kind of that piece. But it's also, yeah, I do have skills. When people come into, my favorite is when people come into my feed and explain to me the definition of ethics. And I'm like, you need to go read my bio, honey, because, like, I'm not having that. Like, that's not why I'm here. Like, you know, Because I can trudge you, and I don't do it very often, but every once in a while, like, I'm just like, no, sweetie, you know, you're not going to come in and be condescending when I have 25 years of experience doing this. And the same way in the classroom. And I've never really, there's been only one or two instances with students where they go into that space, because usually my reputation has preceded me and like people know better than to do that. But do you always have one or two that are like, think they're, you know, I could take her down. She's blonde. She looks sweet, which Come is on. Deceptive, right? Like How I'm good could she not, be? Or they look at me because at the War College, I mean, there's not many people at the War College that wear like leopard cowgirl boots and sparkly things. Right. So like, I have a particular sort of fashion demeanor that sometimes like leads people to think perhaps I'm not a serious person because I don't always dress seriously or seriously in their vein. Like I'm not wearing the black suit. I do. Yeah, but there's a sort of like, do you want to come into this space and rumble? Because if you do, I can. You know, I'm an academically trained philosopher. I survived the meat grinder that is, you know, analytic philosophy to become a full professor, right? You don't get through that without being able to handle yourself, especially in a male-dominated discipline and subfield like I'm in.
Yeah, I think there's a couple of things like I tell, like my social media is completely curated on the tone of fun. Like if you're not fun, right. If I'm not enjoying this, I feel any negativity. It's because I'm just really, I'll do lines, like sort of I'll scissor, you know, things that I don't like with little incisive zings and things. But
I think I saw a couple yesterday.
Yeah. You know, it's jokes or it's insights. That's all I do. And so I'm like, I'm not looking for argument. If you enjoy them, great. But like with comedy, the only acceptable responses are you laugh or you don't.
No. Yeah.
There's no comment necessary. You can leave if you want. That's perfectly fine too. But I don't need to discuss the jokes. They're not statements of philosophy or positions. Right. You know, so, you know, curating that and saying like, I don't allow comments usually. And like any negativity will just get you blocked, like anything. Mm-hmm. Even like a snide, you know, remark will get you lost. Cause I just want to have fun. I don't want to have to fight people and social media.
I think that's fair. And it depends how you use your social media. So I use especially Twitter for conversations, for thinking through ideas, especially as I'm writing. But sometimes it's thinking through things that have happened in class or how I'm going to approach something that I'm teaching. And I want especially the military perspective. Hey, y'all, what do you think about this? And, but for me, it has to be productive. I'm not interested in getting into insults and back and forth and bullying and taking people down in a really personal way, unless they insult my children, which has happened a couple times, and then I'll take you down. Those are my babies. But yeah, you know, there's occasional political commentary. I try not to do that too much, except that I also teach, you know, ethics and social and political philosophy, and teach philosophy of race and gender. So
you're in all the landmines. You're in all the
So I do all the fun stuff, and so it does, you know, intersect.
I would just prefer a friendly environment. I think one of my specialties in argument and this stuff is not letting people be my enemy, and part of it's the comedy thing. Like I also have, you know, a lot of training in interpersonal, and using interpersonal as a rhetorician is, again, it's a little superpower. Like I know how to validate people. I know how to express gratitude. I know how to you know, listen and these kind of things. And that goes a long way to keeping it from becoming combative, because if they're combative, I'm like, well, that was harsh. You know, why do you want to harsh me? Because I just don't like to fight that hard. The same way, like when I do stand up, I don't attack the audience, but I do tons of crowd work. I'll do an hour show and never do a joke that I've written because it's so much fun to talk to people, but it has to stay positive or it just becomes a fight, and I don't want to fight.
Yeah. And so I feel like Twitter, or I mean, Facebook is mostly for me like cat pictures with my mother, right? So I don't use Facebook a ton, but and Instagram is like all my food pictures. So Twitter is a place where I engage, and I want it to be like my classroom. And so I actually use a lot of comedy in my classroom. I know I'm not nearly as funny as you are, but I find that when you're talking about heavy, deep subjects, like a little levity here and there, like kind of keeps it real and keeps people relaxed, and our brains work better when we're relaxed. We're more willing to take in perhaps ideas we wouldn't take in if they're presented in an adversarial way. So for me, social media is an extension of the classroom. And so I run it like I run my classroom, which is for most people pretty a little too loosey-goosey, right? There's no like PowerPoint slides, there's no lecture, any of that kind of stuff. It's Socratic conversation, but I want it to be fun. I want it to be engaging. I want it to be interesting. I want people maybe to think about something that they haven't thought about before. But I'm not interested in fighting with people or the sort of competitive status thing, especially in academic Twitter. There's like a lot of here, let me show you how many books I've written, right? Or how smart I am on this. I think I'm also in a stage in my career where I just don't care about that stuff. Like I'm done hustling. Like I don't have to impress anyone. Like I get that, you know, the young, you know, especially for some younger academics, that's what they're using social media for. And that's fine, but I'm not interested in like playing the, you know, status one up you kind of game. So I think, you know, it's what are you using these things for? I also use it for community. I want to get to know people, right? And I do have a great community. I mean, over the last say 10 years that I've built, and some days it feels a little like, you know, in Cheers when Norm walks into the bar, like you're walking into a familiar space. And if you haven't been there for a few days, you know, you're getting the DMs saying, Pauline, are you okay? What's going on? Like, there's sort of a genuine, like, obviously you have to curate your feed very carefully to get this to happen. But there is a sort of a community, and I have friends that met on Twitter that have gotten married and have been to their weddings. And, you know, so there is a sense of community there that is possible. It's increasingly difficult. But I think it is possible, but I think it's about how do you approach your presence, on social media? And are you just there to take, or are you willing to give too? So part of my view on that is I'm a senior academic, which means it's the time in my career to lift up people who are coming up behind me, right? And to provide mentorship if that's desired, but to be a mouthpiece, to spread the word about the great work they're doing. It's less about the work I'm doing and self-promotion, although I do plenty of that. But it's also about, you know, pulling people up, not pulling the ladder up after me. And especially as a woman in a highly male dominated field, I feel like it's really important for me to, you know, to provide some of that example and that support, right? When people are having a hard day, because academia can be really, really hard. So yes. I really do take that community idea. I know it's kind of schmarmy, but I take that seriously.
I'm perfectly down with that stuff. And again, like I think that sometimes rhetoric can get a sheen of kind of combat, you know, and I get it. And I think that's important to have in rhetoric, because I think it's one of its main offers in the world. But there's also the sense of you're trying to get to the right answers. You're trying to get to the good stuff for the community, for yourself, for humanity. That's the ultimate purpose. It's not to win a small skirmish here. It's to get to good answers that everybody can then use, you know, that will further us in some way. And if you can get people to sign off on, oh, that's what I'm trying to do here. I don't care if you win at this argument. I don't care if at the end of it, are we in a good place? Have we got an idea that's functional and it's going to, you know, do good things in the world? And that's the victory, right? Everything else is just kind of, you know, bumble around it.
Yeah. Or have I, maybe I've expanded your view or you've expanded my view. Have I given you something? I hope when my students leave my classroom, I would say, if your head hurts when you leave here, like it's because you're thinking hard and that's a good thing. Did I get you to think about something? It's not about, I don't get a commission based on whether you agree with Plato at the end of my class, but did I get you to think about something that you hadn't thought about before? And I think this is really important in the context of things like philosophy of race and philosophy of gender. Not that you agree with the views that we read, but does this help you think about something in a different way than you did before, right? Can you understand someone's perspective, even if you don't agree with it, maybe in a different way than you did before? And you need some safety to get people to be able to take intellectual risks like that. And I think in our current environment, we don't have a lot of safety. There's a lot of combativeness and a lot of, you know, in order for me to win, you have to lose. And not just that you have to lose, I have to humiliate you in the process. I have to denigrate your identity. I have to denigrate where you're coming from. And as a philosopher, I find that really problematic, even though some of the worst offenders are in my own discipline, right? But it's, you know, I have a love-hate relationship with my own discipline. So, and I always have, right?
Yeah, not surprising. I find it like in the terms of politics, I never really did politics until Trump showed up and made it interesting. And I'm like, okay, he imported a bunch of entertainment stuff, which is what I studied, into politics. And I'm like, everybody's like, you know, they're losing their minds. I'm like, he's just doing entertainment principles. You know, he's doing reality show. He's doing promoter talk. He's creating conflict, all the normal things that you have to do to get people to pay attention to entertainment, to narratives. And so I'm like, why you keep responding to him like he's in politics when he's changed the game into entertainment politics? And I think the left still doesn't understand what's happened, that this is a new type of discourse that's slammed into politics. You know, Reagan played drama, he could do drama, and he was really right. Good at the lofty speeches and being dramatic. And you know, there was a kind of a sense of George Bush was a little bit comic, and yeah. You know, and Clinton was wry and ironic, you know, but then Trump just crashed. And I sometimes describe him as he's the clown that jumped behind the wheel of the Porsche. You know, he's like, the Porsche is all built, I just got to get in there, and he just took off. And you're like, how'd that happen? I'm like, well, you know, again, I think the value of something like rhetoric or philosophy degree is it gives people explanations for things that are just completely confusing to them when they're trying to think of it with their ordinary tools and the ordinary schemes that they have for how the world works. And with rhetoric, at least, like I can say, this is just discourse games. Like, I don't care really about his morals or his ethics or the politics. He's playing a discourse game. And if you want to counter that discourse game, then describe the discourse game and design your, you know, ways of countering it. And I'm still trying to get that into the world. And that was sort of how I get drawn in, like, okay, I need to start a podcast and actually start talking about this stuff again. Cause it's that value that people need. You know, you can see it would have value in the world if they could do these things.
They could. Yeah. So as an ethicist, you know, I think Trump always struck me because my son is into WWE and WWF, and you know, so that's always how Trump sort of struck me. So I think that entertainment discourse is helpful. So as an ethicist, one of the things I wonder, maybe you have a perspective on this, you know, from rhetoric perspective, is that I think that is in fact Trump's vibe, but from an ethical point of view, people took that permission structure, that outrageous permission structure, and then applied that as like an ethical or social norm standard. Like, so Trump is sort of playing a jerk, but now I'm free to actually be a jerk, not just to play one, but to be one in my office with my wife, with my kids. And so I wonder if you have thoughts about how we make sense of like something that with Trump, it is really this sort of entertainment notion, but then other people, maybe even like some of his supporters, some of them I think understood that, but maybe other people don't understand. And it was like, yeah, he's saying a bunch of stuff I've been wanting to say for years. And couldn't say because my wife would get mad at me. But now I have a permission structure to, now it's okay to say those things. So how do you think about from a rhetoric point of view, like that move? Or am I wrong about that move? Because that's what I see from sort of an ethical point of view.
No, I think you're right on it. Kenneth Burke, language philosopher, he has the line of language or stories as equipment for living.
Yeah, yeah.
And that essentially is what I think Trump did, is that he imported all these things that were stories to him, and he's a sociopath, you know, like this entertainment sociopath. He's just an actor. Give him any role, he's not going to judge it. He's just going to do it.
He's going to do it. Yeah.
And so, but when people saw that and demonstrated, and this is what literature and our stories and everything do, they you said, they give you models for it. They normalize it. And what's happened now from a rhetoric perspective of private life and public life being merged in the digital, people can't really tell the difference. The markers have been moved. And so they don't know that Trump is mostly acting. They can't apply that, those marker that demarcates fiction and nonfiction. And so, yeah, it does. It completely gives them permission to import this into real life.
Yeah, so I think it's like with Jerry Springer, there was a point, like we all knew this was like acting and whatever, like these weren't, it wasn't like, it was real in a sense, but not real. Like, so I think if you ask people about reality shows, I think they know they're scripted, they know all of this, but then is there some ways in which some of the behavior on reality shows that we just get used to it? Right. And I made this argument years ago with interrogational torture. Is there just some way in which, you know, even if we do it in select circumstances, like it gets normalized. Right. And then it gets moved. So it's like with your kids, like you let them stay up late for New Year's Eve. And then the next day they're like, hey, last night we had to stay up. Why can't we stay up tonight? And so that move then has, I think, really clear ethical implications. And I speak as a mother of two children of color, right? And the environment in the last 5 years, I mean, it was coming with the Tea Party, but the environment in the last 5 years in terms of the safety of my children has markedly changed. And even my own safety as a woman, right? So I think that's an interesting thing to think about, and maybe thinking more about rhetoric helps people, you know, think about what's actually going on and what is actually happening, and then how to respond to that, right? Which I think is the important kind of question, because I'm not sure that the responses have been successful.
Yeah, they're not matching what's being brought to the table by the other side. Like, they're bringing hardcore narratives and production and characters and, you know, all these kabuki theater of good and evil and all these kind of things like critical race theory and, mm-hmm. you know, all these terms that mean nothing but have emotional value still. And so the left is not doing the same thing. They're sitting around trying to deconstruct the narratives of the right. I'm like, then you're just talking about what they've put on the table. I mean, that's a bad strategy. You ought to build your own narratives. You know, if you're losing the white vote, you know, now maybe the suburban white vote again and the rural white vote, then build a mythology and a set of discourse that talks to those people instead of telling them that this stuff that's resonating with you, it's bad.
It's not really what I think. As someone who teaches, now I'm gonna get a lot of hate mail. I actually do teach, among other things, critical race theory, right? The jurisprudence version of it.
Yeah. How dare you?
But then people say, well, that's not what's really, it doesn't matter what's actually being taught or what critical race theory really is. No one cares about that. That was used, it's explicitly used as sort of an emotional marker for all of these conversations about race that you don't want to have or that make you uncomfortable. And most Americans are in fact really uncomfortable, especially white Americans are uncomfortable with these conversations. I wonder about sort of the fact checking. Like, I think certain elements of society. But well, if we just fact check things, if we just tell people,
yeah, rhetorically, it's an awful strategy.
But we believe, like, I believe all kinds of things that you could fact check until the cows come home. Like, and it's not necessarily going to change, you know, my view on things. Right. So I'm still going to put cookies out for Santa Claus this year. You can fact check that stuff as my teenagers do now all the time. And they're like, come on, Mom. No, I like putting cookies out for Santa.
Hey, it's fun. Like, right.
I like the ritual of it. I like the whimsy of it. I like the fun of it.
Yeah.
Are there certain things that, you know, that like you said, have that emotional pull, or they're socially bonding, gluing kinds of things, or an experience that we all go through together? We just had Halloween. We're all like dressing up as people were really not. But there's something fun about it and emotionally satisfying about it. And so I think that this is my issue with the lack of, especially philosophical attention to the issue of emotion, especially emotion and ethics. I think we're missing sort of part of the picture. We're not just rational creatures, and we ought not to be just rational creatures. That's part of, you know, emotion is part of who we are as human beings. And so that has to be kind of reckoned with. And I think, you know, our politics are definitely a space that the politicians that you just mentioned that have been successful, and Obama as well, were politicians that were able to appeal in some way to some kind of shared vision or emotional life. Like George W. Bush, not always my favorite person, but standing on the pile after 9/11. Dude, yeah. That worked at an emotional level for all kinds of people who did not like George W. Bush because of the moment, because of emotion, right? You know, and Clinton tapped into something, Obama tapped into something quite different, Reagan tapped into a certain kind of thing, and Trump clearly tapped into something, especially some like anger and the grievance and the discomfort with lots of social changes, right? And in a very complex world that maybe people are having difficulty navigating. Right. Their usual, how they understood things seems up in the air. Right. Seems to have changed. And how do I make sense of that? Right.
Yeah, I think my side of the world, one of the havens of doing rhetoric is that it lets you divorce a lot of the discussion and say, let's just look at the linguistic structures. So what stories are they telling? What language are they using? Like you pulled up, you know, the idea of critical race theory is essentially a supermarker. You know, mm-hmm. it doesn't have to mean anything. It's got the word race in there. It's got the word critical in there. And these are, in theory, these are all devil terms for the right. You know, the idea of being criticized in a critical school and intellectualism and then race in there. And it's just like, yeah, you built a little three-pack devil term that has a nice supermarkerness to it. And what the right or what the left should have done is like, okay, well, I'm going to build a competing term. I'm going to grab that term and rework it so that they had some type of, you know, rhetoric balance there that they could use. Instead, they just kept using this term. I'm like, every time you repeat that term, you're solidifying it for the people that you're trying to bring away from it. So quit, you know, again, just discourse practices and discourse techniques never do that. Never use their suggested term because you're gonna lose that. I don't care how you do it.
So do you think that the left has not been successful in, because, you know, one term that one might use is sort of anti-racism, how could you be against anti-racism or like diversity, equity, and inclusion? I don't think the left has been successful in substituting those things and saying, here's what we're really talking about. And maybe because those things seem bureaucratic or they don't like really convey what they're after. I mean, I think in the last week or so, there have been people saying, no, this is about teaching history, right? It's about teaching all of our history. No, it's about having discussions about race, even difficult discussions about race.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think, you know, that it's had the same, because critical race theory sounds scary. Right.
Yeah,
it sounds like a bunch of crazy professors crazy Marxist professors,
right?
Like who are critical. Sounds like you're going to be mean to people. Theory is like, you know, oh man, it's those eggheads again. Like they're not practical. So it's sort of it's wonderful because it taps into all of those, you know, sort of the anti-intellectualism, the anti-higher ed, because we all know that college is corrupting our young people, right? All those liberal professors who can brainwash students, even though we can't get them to read our syllabus, all of those kinds of things. So it's like, it's perfect. It's, you know, yeah, I don't agree with it, but it's genius, right? It was a genius marketing move. I used to teach business students, right? It's a great marketing move. And now it's scary. And then, oh, this is in your school. Your kindergartner is going to be subjected to this.
Sure. But it's not like everybody else. Once I got a friend who's a rhetorician at A&M, and I think she wrote a book called The Genius of Donald Trump, or uses that phrase. And I'm like, it's not genius. It's trial and error. You know, a lot of this stuff comes down, like I'm sure critical race theory came down from a right wing think tank. And it's like, hey, this term, it's going to have some good energy. Same way fake news and all that other stuff did. And Trump's an actor. He just uses the terms over and over and over again. I'm like, so what the left needs, and this is kind of one of the things, you know, sort of a next year, I launched this podcast and everything this year and wrote a book. And I'm like, the second year, I'm going to try to materialize some of this because they need good creative rhetoricians. It's like, hey, the right is grabbing these terms that sort of float up out of the culture, testing them over and over again until they find like a critical race theory that'll make a difference. If you don't have that over here and you don't have ways to counter that linguistically, you're going to be subjected to that artillery over and over and over. So come up with a system or just quit bitching about the fact that you have nothing to fight with. And that one, you know, like a good creative rhetorician, you know, you go into the terms like, well, which term's problem? What can we replace it with? Can we use irony on it? Can we make it look stupid? You know, and that works a lot of times, but if you don't organize it and have really good people doing it the same way you have like really great writers on The Daily Show and stuff like that, because they come up with great lines, you're going to be in trouble. You just don't have the bullpen to deal with these issues.
Yeah. And I also wonder, I see this in academia a lot, is the response is sort of an academic response. It's the fact-checking response. It's the, this is you're being irrational response, which like, you might think that's true, but that's not in terms of what you do. Persuasion, it's not persuasive to tell someone you're being irrational right now, right? That doesn't, like, I don't know anybody that like works with, and Lord knows I've tried it on my teenagers, right? But it's not persuasive, right? Because there is this, you know, I think that issue and vaccines and masks are not about any of those things. They're about control. Do I feel like I have control over my children's schools and their educational experience? Do I feel like I have control over my children's safety or not? Right. And I think, you know, many parents, especially in that suburban demographic, between vaccines and mask mandates and now questions about curriculum in schools, feel like they don't have control over what's happening to their children. And I think, you know, as a parent, there's nothing now will freak you out faster than feeling like you're losing control of your children or their futures, right? So that's a really like emotional issue. I mean, it's part of why I pulled my kid out of public schools and why he's being homeschooled now, because of not those specific issues, but other issues of control, and his learning disability was not being addressed, and he's African American and he was being profiled and bullied and all these kind of things. So I completely get that impulse, and they appealed right to that impulse and said, you don't have control over your kids and their schools. And that's a really low basic, affects every single day.
Yeah.
So
again, sort of rhetorically, you know, the things that there're vulnerabilities in democracy, you know, from a linguistic perspective, and there's vulnerabilities in sort of modern democracy, especially because of social media can get at them. But what to me has happened is that the right has thrown off the restrictions And they're saying any wound you find, any raw area you find, pour as much as you can on it and blame it on the left. And that is the master strategy. And it works very well because those wounds are coming up constantly and they're naturally occurring. The pandemic and the masks and the fear and all that is just a natural occurrence. And at first it threw them off, but then they're like, just bring up the strategy again, find the rawest areas and blame the left for it. And the left is not doing the same thing. Like they had a little bit there with Trump because he never got the vaccine out, you know, and so like he's killing everybody. If you remember the last part of the election was they found one. Hey, he's murdering America. I would have hit it even harder, but
that's a pretty profound, like killing your own people, like as a leader. That's, you know, we don't have high standards for our politicians, but there's a basic level on which you shouldn't kill. And not just Americans, but killing his own voters. Right.
Well, that was the Saddam. That was ultimately the, you know, the indictment that gets Saddam Hussein, right? He was gassing the Kurds.
He was gassing like his
chemical,
own people.
Chemical warfare. That's worth us invading, you know. Is the evil strong enough that it would make me change my behavior? And like you said, your moral choices and that kind of stuff. So fascinating. Well, I've kept you over an hour.
Great conversation though. Thank you. Hopefully.
Yeah, super.
You got some good stuff in there.
Yeah, for sure. Come back anytime. I enjoyed sort of, again, reaching over into like, sometimes I describe what I do. Like I have a marketing agency here in Austin now, and a lot of what I do for businesses is just organize information because their information is so badly organized. I'm like, you can't do communication until your information is organized. That's a bad idea. And so being able to talk to somebody that's what you do, you know, all the time is organize your information in your mind. It's pretty cool.
Thanks. And so appreciate always talking to a rhetorician, but appreciate the conversation. Happy to come back anytime. And if there's anything I can do be helpful for you, please give a shout out.
Awesome. Well, cool. Super fun. Thanks for showing up. This has been the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. Get out there and change the world. It won't change itself. Oh, I hit. Okay. I'm just going to end the meeting. Bye.
Okay. Thanks.